Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Authorities in Texas say they're mobilizing every available resource after a fifth bomb exploded there overnight, this time at a FedEx facility near San Antonio. The 1 a.m. explosion injured one worker and has authorities speculating that it's related to four previous bombings in Austin, three placed in packages and one detonated on a sidewalk with a tripwire. Here's Acting Special Agent Frank Ortega of the ATF at today's briefing.
We have agents from across the country. We have our national response team here. We got explosive detection canines here. We have intel research specialists. We're working hand in hand with our FBI partners, state and local partners. We've been working around the clock.
KUT's Matt Largie joins us from Austin with more. And Matt, first of all, just give us the latest. It sounds like there's some more information coming out today.
That's right. Yeah, we've heard from the San Antonio police chief who said that there is actually a second unexploded package at that Schertz facility, that FedEx facility in Schertz, Texas, which is about 50 miles south of Austin. But we're working to get some further confirmation on that. We've spoken with the Schertz Police Department there, and they're unsure of whether that's the case, or at least they're not saying. In that briefing that the FBI did earlier, they did refuse to answer a lot of questions about the details of what exactly happened at this facility. So we're kind of awaiting further confirmation of some of these details.
Do we have any idea who the package was addressed to, the one that did explode?
No. We don't know what the name was of the person who it was addressed to. Again, FBI officials refused to answer that question at the briefing that they held a short while ago. It has been widely reported that it was addressed to Austin, that it was headed to Austin. We do know, however, that we're told by police in a town called Sunset Valley, which is actually kind of in Austin. It's a separate town within Austin, that the package was sent from a FedEx office there. So the FBI is at that office. They've closed it down, cordoned it off. They're searching for evidence there. And then there is also another FedEx facility in Austin out by our airport that was closed down and evacuated earlier this morning. Reports of a suspicious package there, but it has also been reported that the package originally went through that facility. So police and FBI agents are also searching that facility.
Now, after the first bombing, there was speculation that the attacks could be racially motivated. But at this point, the victims have been Black, Hispanic, and white. What do we know about that?
That's right. Yeah. Police at first, after the first victim was killed on March 2nd, police sort of thought that this was an isolated incident. But then, of course, there were two more packages that exploded last week. And so the victims in those first three explosions were Black and Hispanic. And so the explosions that happened on Sunday in a different part of town, those two victims who were injured were white. So at this point, police thought they weren't ruling out a hate crime, but now they're not so sure. The one on Sunday was much more random than the ones in the past.
Well, what about the question of whether at least one of these is a copycat bomb? Let's listen here to Mike Bouchard, retired ATF agent, now chief security officer at Janus Global Operation.
A copycat may try and mimic the devices that he or she heard about and try and make it look like it's from the same person. Or good bomb builders may change it up. They may, let me try a different type of device this time.
Have authorities addressed that issue?
Well, our police chief, Austin's police chief, addressed the city council a short time ago, and he said that he believes all of these bombs are connected. There has been speculation out there that perhaps one of these could be a copycat, but at this point, officials are not giving any credence to that speculation.
And there's no word about suspects. We're reading that authorities are following more than 500 leads.
That's right. Yeah. Over the past week or so, there have been many, many calls coming into the police tip line about these bombings. At a briefing on it was yesterday, I believe, police and FBI said they they do have some people of interest, but they don't have any suspects at this point. That may, however, change with what happened at these FedEx facilities. Obviously, if a package was mailed from a FedEx office, there are likely to be security cameras in the area or in that office. So the suspect picture may change very soon.
And in terms of the victims, we're learning more about the injured from yesterday's sidewalk bombing, two men in their 20s.
That's right. Yeah. Two men in their 20s from Southwest Austin. They are said to be in good condition at this point, but we honestly don't know much more about them. I know police have been trying to protect their privacy in terms of allowing media access to them.
That's Matt Largy of KUT joining us from Austin with the latest on the bombings and attempted bombings. Matt, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, you remember when President Trump called Oakland's Mayor Libby Schaaf a disgrace after she warned of impending raids by federal immigration agents. There are communities working closely with immigration and custom enforcement officials. WHYY's Laura Benshoff reports on what's driving these collaborations in eastern Pennsylvania.
In 2009, a police officer arrested a man for shoplifting more than $300 in merchandise from a Kohl's department store in Bensalem, a township in eastern Pennsylvania. A crime that would usually result in a fine or short jail sentence instead opened the door to something else, said Bensalem Police Department Public Safety Director Fred Heron.
And we found during the course of the arrest that he was in the country undocumented, whatever the politically correct term is at the moment. And we had called ICE just to see if they were interested, and they were.
Heron's officers processed the man and then, in his words, turned him over to ICE.
And it was at that point we realized that there's a partnership that could be had to help get criminals off the street.
Heron says the Bensalem Police Department worked with ICE for a few years, but that partnership died down around 2012. Then last year, his phone rang.
We get a call about 2-3 weeks after President Trump is inaugurated that, hey, ICE basically saying we're back in business. Are you still interested in 287G? And I said, yeah, I'm very interested.
Entering the United States without a visa or the approval of a border agent breaks federal immigration law. Enforcing those laws usually falls to the federal government, the same way the IRS goes after people who don't pay their taxes. But 287G agreements are a way for ICE to give some of its powers to local police departments. Federal immigration officers want to work with local police because it means they can get more done. ICE called other police chiefs, too, like Jim Donnelly with the Warminster Township Police.
It's a tool. Am I going to turn down a tool that's going to help protect some young victim or some victim in general? No.
According to public records, 19 county jails, sheriff's offices, and police departments across Pennsylvania responded to ICE that they would be interested in learning more and potentially carrying out ICE's work. That means interviewing people about their immigration status and putting them into deportation proceedings. Critics of these kinds of partnerships say they lead to abuses of power at the local level and make police departments vulnerable to lawsuits. So far, no 287G agreements exist in Pennsylvania, but some places aren't waiting for this type of contract to do more to help ICE. Tom Gross heads up the Pennsylvania Chiefs of Police Association.
Some departments have increased their cooperation with ICE.
He says with immigration enforcement picking up under Trump, local police may just be following orders.
Some of the decision-making comes from their elected body. You know, some elected officials, mayor, council, whoever's overseeing the chief says, we want to be aggressive with illegal immigrants.
That could mean calling up ICE when they arrest someone in the country illegally, as five police departments in southeastern Pennsylvania reported they do. None besides Bensalem agreed to an interview. Golnaz Fakimi with the ACLU of Pennsylvania says turning someone over to ICE when they look like they could have been born in another country is illegal.
To speak very clearly and plainly, what we're talking about here in practice as a problem is racial profiling.
She's also concerned about a chilling effect, that victims or witnesses of crimes may not cooperate with local police if they fear their loved ones could be deported. Lorena Ayala is a U.S. citizen, but not everyone in her family is. She spoke at a recent Bensalem Council meeting where more than 150 people came to protest ramping up cooperation with ICE.
I have seen many of my friends and loved ones arrested unjustly. But my hope has always been that the law enforcement will continue to protect us and will continue to do the right thing.
She told me later that her uncle ended up in ICE custody after being stopped by police for rolling through a stop sign. Fear now keeps some of her family members from going out. And it's stories like hers that give people like Warminster Police Chief Jim Donnelly pause about whether or not partnering with ICE is a good idea.
And I would have to vet that through all my stakeholders, meaning my board of supervisors, my community, my department, people that are all going to be involved in what's going on.
He says even if he wants to help ICE more, there may not be enough manpower to go around in his small police force. His officers are tied up enforcing traffic laws and solving local crimes. For Here and Now, I'm Laura Benshoff.
Yesterday, we told you how conspiracy theorists driven by InfoWars host Alex Jones have been harassing survivors of mass shootings, including at the church in Sutherland Springs, Texas, where Pastor Frank Pomeroy's daughter Annabelle was killed with 25 others.
They have been accusing all the neighbors, the parishioners, everyone involved, that we are all traitors to our country because we are trying to carry out a Department of Homeland Security drill to entice the rest of the country to have to live in fear, and that none of our family members or loved ones have existed, that this was all made up.
Just awful. And the man encouraging many of these conspiracies is Alex Jones. Here he is ranting about CNN's Brian Stelter.
You will not bring humanity down. God is going to destroy you. Get him off the screen. They're so evil. Just please, God, free us from them.
Well, Brennan Gilmore has been targeted by Jones-inspired conspiracy theorists as well, and he's decided to sue. Brennan was recording with his cell phone at that August neo-Nazi rally in Charlottesville when he caught the moment the driver plowed his car into a group of counter-protesters, killing 32-year-old Heather Heyer. It is gruesome. Brennan shared his video with police and the media and says ever since, he's been so threatened by conspiracy theorists, he's needed protection. Brennan is on leave from the State Department. He now works bringing IT jobs to underserved communities in Virginia. He is suing Alex Jones and several others. He's being represented by the Civil Rights Clinic at Georgetown Law and joins us from the NPR studios in Washington. Brennan, hi.
Hello.
How bad did it get?
I mean, it was bad pretty quickly on, and it's been sustained for the months afterwards. You know, I think I received my first death threat within days of posting that video, and I received the last one that I know about just in the last few weeks.
Well, because why? What are the conspiracy theorists saying about you?
Well, the conspiracy theories are wide-ranging and variant. You know, they range from things as extreme as I was an orchestrator of genocide when I was in Africa with the Foreign Service and then was trained to come back and orchestrate an operation in Charlottesville funded by George Soros or Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton or the Illuminati, you name it, to put violence in Charlottesville in order to promote a left-wing, democratic, or globalist agenda. If I have a hard time summarizing them, it's because there's so many of these different conspiracy theories, it's hard to keep up.
You were in government. You served in the U.S. Foreign Service. You just alluded to that. You're currently on leave from the Department of State.
That's correct.
So that thin thread is what a lot of these conspiracy theorists have pulled. You know, you're in the government. How could you possibly have been positioned in that moment in Charlottesville at that time if you weren't part of staging this event? What's it like to hear your name spoken by Alex Jones?
I mean, it's, you know, anytime someone makes baseless lies about you and twists a service in the federal government that you're very proud of, you know, it's incredibly hurtful.
Well, and you're saying it's the equivalent of yelling fire in a crowded movie theater. We reached out to Alex Jones, by the way, for his response. We haven't heard back. But he did double down on his claims about you after you launched your lawsuit. Here's a little bit of Alex Jones last week. He said you were in Charlottesville to push a leftist PR agenda. Let's listen.
Brennan Gilmore, you ought to look him up.
Why is it this guy is all over the news everywhere, and he's the guy that gets interviewed, and he shoots the video and everything, and then he's a leftist that worked for a congressman and got money from George Soros and all the rest of it. Clearly, he's been picked to be on the news because he's this PR guy from the State Department.
Okay, Brennan Gilmore, have you received money from George Soros?
I have not received money from George Soros. I worked for a candidate for governor who received a campaign contribution from George Soros. And this is the tactic that these people do to bully and intimidate, is they take, you know, vague data points from your bio, the fact that I'd worked in government, the fact that I'd worked in Democratic politics, and then draw these fantastical lines that are, you know, an attempt to provoke fear and hatred among their listeners, and completely obscure the truth about what happens in any given situation that they're covering. And we've seen this from Sandy Hook to Charlottesville to Parkland and into Sutherland, which I know you had discussed earlier in the program.
Well, look, as we spoke to the pastor in Sutherland Springs and his wife, they lost a child, and they have these conspiracy theorists telling them that they didn't. That's repugnant. Tell us more about why you feel so strongly that you were impacted by this. What are some of the other things that have happened?
There were people who put my parents' address online. People sent envelopes to the house. When I opened them, there was, you know, white powder. I had people in my sphere, in the musical community I play in, who believed in these things and walked away from me and any friendship with me because of it. But there's also major professional consequences from having people who put on the mantle of journalism and then post this stuff on the internet where it resides forever. And so people that I have had to meet in a professional context, or when I return to the State Department and try to represent my country overseas, they will see on the internet these horrific allegations that I'm essentially a killer, or at least complicit in a murderous operation in Charlottesville. And that will continue to affect me in the future as well.
Well, look, are you heartened by the fact that Jones has had to settle? He went after the yoga company Chobani, whose owner was Turkish. He famously hired immigrants, and Alex Jones ravaged him, posting a video on InfoWars titled, "Idaho Yogurt Maker Caught Importing Migrant Rapists." Well, Chobani sued. They said Jones had caused harm. They sought damages of $10,000 and a retraction. They settled. Jones apologized, removed the post. But Brennan, before that video was viewed tens of thousands of times. Are you disheartened at how many followers Alex Jones has?
I mean, I'm disheartened, but I'm also unclear about how many of those represent real human beings. I mean, I think this is an element of this discussion, the broader discussion we have to have right now about, social media and how these platforms are used. In my last 6 months, I've received countless messages on various social media platforms, and I don't know who's behind them. I don't know if it's a real human being or a bot. Yes, I do know that there are legitimate followers of Alex Jones, and it is troubling. And I think, you know, that's one of the motivations I have in bringing this case, is to ensure that what's happened to me doesn't happen to other people, but also to expose the methodology of these people who are pretending to be journalists and pretending to have a legitimate voice in civic discourse, but who are in fact not following the basic ethics of journalism and not even following the law that governs journalism when it comes to defamation.
We remember, too, that it was Alex Jones that promoted that unbelievable claim that Hillary Clinton and her campaign chairman were keeping children enslaved in the Washington, D.C. pizzeria Comet Ping Pong. And it was one thing that they were getting unbelievably attacked by people at this pizzeria because they thought there was a children's slave ring in the basement. But then a man from North Carolina comes in with a gun, fires shots, thinking he's going to liberate these non-existent children. In that case, Alex Jones apologized to the pizzeria. You and your lawyers don't want a settlement. You don't want money or an apology. You want a court to decide if Jones is lying and defaming you. That's a tricky, tricky slope. Brennan, journalists wrestle with this all the time. How do you call someone a liar when the definition of lying is you have to know it's not the truth? Can't they say, well, we didn't know, you know, we heard these things?
Well, there's, you know, in many cases, no attempt to look into the truth, and we're looking forward to the process to determine that.
Are you ready for the onslaught that will happen as you proceed with this lawsuit?
No. I mean, I don't know where this is going. But, you know, I did know that it will continue to change my life. But that's the whole point. You know, when I posted that video, I was doing that under the belief that this was a civic duty I had because I had just witnessed an incredibly brutal attack by a white supremacist in my town in 2017. And that video shows the stakes of the expression of that white supremacy in a very violent way. I posted that online, and then these outlets came after me and attacked me, defamed my name, defamed my reputation, and led to threats to me and my family. In a very real way, that decision was made by them and not by me. With this suit, my main motivation is ensuring that others don't have this happen to them.
Brennan, are you encouraged by others who are stepping forward? We see the family of Seth Rich, the Democratic National Committee staffer who was killed in a robbery in D.C. Fox News Channel was behind the theory that he was killed by Democrats because he'd leaked emails. They retracted that story, but his parents, Seth Rich's parents, are suing Fox News Channel.
Others are stepping forward, and I can't say I'm heartened by it. I'm saddened by it because it shows the reach of these people. But I do think, you know, these cases will move us forward. And I was very heartened by the fact that when we dropped this lawsuit last Tuesday, it has triggered harassment, but it's also triggered an outpouring of support that I think shows that with this lawsuit and with these actions of the other victims of Alex Jones, we have tapped into a very strong sentiment of outrage about the role that these people are playing in our civic discourse right now and the very deleterious role that they have in getting us to this moment we're at right now as a country.
Brennan, have you approached the president at all? President Trump has appeared on Alex Jones' program.
I have not approached the president.
Yeah. Your thoughts?
My thoughts on the president and Alex Jones?
Yeah.
The accreditation of Gateway Pundit and InfoWars to the White House gave them a credibility they don't deserve.
Accreditation. Their reporters were accredited to go into the White House for the pools that we see, the press pools we see.
Correct. And I think, you know, that type of credibility granted to an organization which has come after me in such a defamatory way, it gives their actions against me a much greater consequence in terms of my reputation and my future in this country. And I think that's a problem that we look forward to discussing in court.
That's Brennan Gilmore. And as he just said, he filmed the moment a car plowed into a crowd in that neo-Nazi rally last year in Charlottesville. And because of his posting that video and talking about it, he then became the target of conspiracy theorists. He's now suing Alex Jones of InfoWars. Brennan, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And others in Brennan's lawsuit, Gateway Pundit publisher Jim Hoft, former Breitbart news writer Lee Stranahan, InfoWars reporter Leanne McAdoo, former Congressman Alan West, and blogger Scott Crichton and Derek Wilburn. We'll have a link to the lawsuit at hereandnow.org. Sad news. Sudan, the world's last surviving male northern white rhino, has died at 45, which is about 90 in human years. Born in Sudan, he lived at a conservancy in Kenya and was beloved. The world's most eligible bachelor, he was called on a Tinder fundraising app. Here's one of his caretakers in a recent PBS documentary.
He's an old man. We really take great care of him, just like elderly people.
Like elderly people. Vicky Krogh hosts WBUR's The Wildlife Blog. Vicky, so sad to say the world's last, but this wasn't unexpected.
No, not unexpected, but so sad, as you say, just the same. By all accounts, Sudan, as an individual rhino, was a sweetheart. As you heard there from the caretaker, they treated him like a dear old man. But he was in decline. He was sleeping a lot and was increasingly arthritic. He was also battling a deep infection in his back right leg. He was clearly suffering and couldn't stand up, and that's why he was euthanized yesterday. That's got to be so hard for the caretakers who had the closest relationship with Sudan, remarkably close, especially when you consider how massive he was. Northern white rhinos can weigh about 5,000 pounds, yet the caretakers could rub his belly and sit with him when he napped. And a kind of eulogy for Sudan, a statement from the conservancy, made a point of characterizing this grand old rhino for his dignity and strength.
Well, tell us more about his life and what he faced.
Sudan's life has been well documented, and that, of course, has been because he was part of an ambitious conservation effort to save his subspecies, the northern white rhino. That's one of two subspecies of one white rhino. In the last years, the remaining northern white rhinos had to be protected from poachers by armed guards around the clock. Poaching's a problem for all rhinos, and they're killed for their horns. horns, largely supplying illegal markets in parts of Asia. But adding to that, northern white rhinos have had a huge problem working against them for decades. Much of their range had been in countries where civil war and instability made them even more vulnerable. Mm-hmm. They used to be found in parts of Chad, Sudan, Uganda, Congo, and Central African Republic. So zoos around the world have participated in trying to save this subspecies, in part trying to get them to reproduce in captivity. Sudan's own story is amazing. He was a wildlife round tripper. He was captured in the wild in Sudan and lived much of his life, more than 30 years, at a zoo in the Czech Republic before coming back to Africa.
Well, and now he leaves just his daughter and granddaughter, two female rhinos. There is technology, but how do you preserve the northern white rhino? Yeah,
27-year-old Najin and Sudan's daughter, Suzanne's daughter, and the other is her 17-year-old daughter, Fatou. And I know this sounds pretty counterintuitive, but Sudan's death doesn't really change the equation all that much. The subspecies is already considered extinct in the wild. None of the two remaining northern white rhinos alive today is capable of reproducing naturally anyway, and weren't even at the end of Sudan's life. So efforts to save the subspecies were already in the realm of high-end assisted reproduction. Mm-hmm. The Czech Republic Zoo has been a major player, and they say that Sudan could still have an offspring. According to the statement, they say that preservation is only possible with IVF techniques using eggs from the two remaining females stored northern rhino semen from males and surrogate southern white rhino females.
So people are still going to be working on it. He might have an afterlife because of technology. But what an impression he made. Sudan died at 45, 90 in human years, leaves behind the two females and a technology that even with his DNA, which they collected yesterday in a ritual, may be able to someday reproduce. Vicky Croak, our guide to the animal world. Vicky, too many eulogies, though, but thank you.
I know. We'll get some births in there, yeah, Robin.
Thank you.
A lot of change is happening in Cuba. Relations with the U.S. are still tense, but the island is slowly opening up to the outside world. Just recently, a construction crew from Detroit was at Ernest Hemingway's home in Cuba. The Nobel Prize-winning author lived on a hillside overlooking Havana for two decades. And now there's an effort underway to preserve the manuscripts and artifacts that he left behind. Here in Now's Peter O'Dowd has the story from Havana.
Last month, I found myself navigating the busy streets of the Cuban capital, amazed by vestiges of the Cold War and a U.S. blockade. The mid-century Chevys and Buicks in various states of perfection or rusted decay. It's a city without Starbucks, without Uber, without any of the corporate brands that sell on nearly every other street corner across the globe. A city alive with open-air cafes and bars like this one, where, according to legend, a famous American writer loved to drink. The story goes that Ernest Hemingway downed mojitos here at the Bodeguita del Medio in Old Havana and then walked a few blocks to the El Floradita, where he was known to swallow a dozen daiquiris or more in a single sitting. Hemingway was a regular at the Floradita bar for years, but I came to Cuba to see his home.
Hemingway was, for Cuba, a Nobel Prize.
Luis Enrique Gonzalez is my guide at Hemingway's house. The author called it Finca Vigia, the lookout house, on a hill overlooking the bustle of Havana. A stand of bamboo rustles outside Hemingway's study.
This is maybe the most important place. Why? Because we are now in the room of Hemingway, and we are now in front of that typing machine, that exactly typing machine where Hemingway wrote The Old Man and the Sea. You know, the book that gave to Hemingway the Nobel Prize. And here, finish the novel of On the Boat Tolls.
There's a lot of animals on the wall.
Yeah, Hemingway loved to hunt.
An impala, a water buffalo, a kudu's twisted antlers hanging in the dining room. In the bathroom, a faded list of numbers written on the wall.
It's because Hemingway used to check his wave 7 times a day in that scale, you know. And they write the width and the size on the wall, you know.
He was worried about being too fat.
Yeah.
Maybe he should have had fewer than 12 daiquiris every day.
Yeah. And look at the, it's normal. I always say that it's normal if you have some magazines in the bathroom. But look at a lot of books in the bathroom.
Books on baseball, books on witchcraft, books on everything. 9,000 in all scattered around the house.
It's rustic. It's just a low 7-room bungalow, yet it's filled with everything that the author collected.
Mary Jo Adams leads the U.S.-based Finca Vigía Foundation. With help from the Cuban government, it's dedicated to preserving Hemingway's legacy on the island.
Well, he lived there from 1939 to 1960, one-third of his life, and it was really the only place where he put down roots. So as you walk through the house, you see letters from he wrote to his mother from summer camp in Michigan. You see trophies from when he was a little boy. It's where he collected things in trunks and brought them to Cuba. There's also a phonograph in the living room that still works, and occasionally the staff will put on albums of American gospel music, or one of his favorite things was opera. When those musical notes, you hear them in the air and you look out and you see the trees and the garden. And the house is as he left it, so it's as though he's just gone for a swim in the pool and is ready to come back.
That you make an excellent point. Like much of Cuba, actually, that house appears to be frozen in time.
Yes.
Is that part of the allure?
I think it is part of the allure. Cubans had a lot of photographs of Hemingway living in his home, and we had a lot in the JFK Library in Boston, which has a very large, extensive Hemingway collection. We put our two groups of photographs together and saw that this was where he had his chair. This was where he liked to set up his bar. Mm. This was the painting that he always had over the dining room table, and this was his favorite crystal. So it really has a sense of on purpose of what it was like in the mid-50s when he lived there.
So give me a little more history then. He lived there in the 1950s, as you say, but he left in 1960. That was about a year after the Castro Revolution took hold in Cuba. But why did he up and leave the house?
Well, there are various stories or theories. His health was not good. And I was told that his fourth wife, Mary, really wanted him to go to Spain or take a trip. Maybe he would feel better, be less depressed. And they traveled a bit. She brought him back to Idaho. He went to a medical clinic and committed suicide while they were abroad.
Not long after he left the home in Cuba.
Maybe a year, maybe 9 months. I'm not certain of that.
Yeah. But at that time, then, the regime, the Castro regime, was in full effect. What was the relationship like between Hemingway's wife? Did she want to get his personal belongings back to the United States? Because at that point, the relationship had broken down between the two countries.
It had broken down. But what I understand is that Mrs. Hemingway enlisted the help of Mrs. Kennedy to retrieve some of her husband's personal effects and...
And that's the First Lady, Mrs. Kennedy.
Exactly. She had a great Mrs. Kennedy had a great respect for the arts, for culture, and for Ernest Hemingway.
Ultimately, many of his belongings never made it back to the United States. The Cuban government took over the house and everything in it. They turned it into a museum. But time and the weather were hard on what was left of the author's legacy in Cuba. In 2005, the National Trust for Historic Preservation called the home one of America's most endangered historic places.
I first went there as a termite expert. And
I remember fact, that.
That's home renovation TV star Bob Vila. He's on the foundation's board, and he got on the phone to join my conversation with Mary Jo Adams.
It had an unusual double set of roofing on it that was being redone. All the windows had rotted out, and they were making new wooden casement windows on site.
Vila and the foundation helped renovate the home. They also began a project to preserve the manuscripts, letters, and photographs on site. They got permission to bring U.S. tools and materials onto the island. And just last week, a team from Detroit was there to work with Cuban architects and engineers. They're building a sealed vault so the preserved artifacts will last for generations.
What we did specifically was design this building simply. It's 2,400 square feet. And Cuba is, as a nation, is so rich in culture. Yet all of the museums in Cuba have the same problem of sunlight, humidity, termites, pests. And so lessons learned at the Hemingway Museum can be extended throughout all of the provinces in Cuba. And although we don't intend to build buildings throughout the country, the architectural drawings, the plans, the materials list are available for the Ministry of Culture to work with if they choose to build more of these special museum-quality archival storage facilities with laboratories.
Well, as you know, the Trump administration has rolled back some of the Obama-era policies that opened the U.S.-Cuba relationship after so many years of tensions. How have you been able to navigate this project through the sensitive geopolitical concerns of the two countries?
Well, we've worked through several administrations over the past 14 years, and we do it, I think, rather successfully because we are not political. We always talk about Ernest Hemingway being a citizen of the world. Hmm. So what you find at Finca Vejia are documents from Spain, from Africa, from the United States, from Cuba, from Mexico. Both governments have seen that, which I think is a credit to Ernest Hemingway. I wonder what he would think about that.
And the spirit of the effort does resemble Hemingway's relationship to the Cuban people. Back at Finca Vejia, my guide, Luis Enrique Gonzalez, says he grew up a few blocks from here, listening to stories from his grandmother, who came to the house as a girl to eat mangoes.
The Hemingway opened the gates to this huge house to all the kids, to all the neighbors that want to go here.
And Gonzalez says he did it because the Finca Vejia is where the American writer felt at home.
He always say that he speak Cuban, he not speak Spanish. And he say in that occasion, yo soy un cubano sato. That means I'm a regular Cuban, you know. And for the Cuban people, that American guy came to Cuba, decided to live in Cuba, and feel like a Cuban in that difficult moment that Cuba were living was like a gift.
Just like the legacy of his home in Cuba is today. For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
Tempe, Arizona Police Chief Sylvia Moyer says a preliminary investigation into the first known death related to a self-driving vehicle is likely not the fault of Uber, which owns the vehicle. On Sunday night, 49-year-old Elaine Hertzberg was struck and killed in Tempe. Uber has suspended operation of its self-driving cars in the Phoenix area, as well as San Francisco, Toronto, and Pittsburgh. Let's get to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Johanna Buya is a senior editor at Recode. She covers transportation. Hi, Johanna.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, what more do we know about the crash right now? The Tempe police chief has made this statement about the initial investigation, but that police force isn't the only governing body looking into the accident.
No, the National Transportation Safety Board, the federal agency that looks into traffic accidents across the country, is joining the Tempe police in investigating the accident. And like you said, the initial analysis and the initial findings of the investigation, which has yet to be concluded, is that Uber may not be at fault because Elaine Hertzberg actually crossed the street in the middle of the road, not at the crosswalk.
Now, the car was in autonomous mode, but the car also had a human driver behind the wheel. Isn't that supposed to prevent an accident like this?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the job of the vehicle operator. When the autonomous system fails, or if the vehicle operator expects the autonomous system to fail, they're supposed to be able to take back control of the vehicle. The issue is we don't have the conclusions from the investigation, so we don't actually know if it's the operator's fault at this point or if it was a software failure. Uber itself has yet to gain access to that vehicle because the Tempe police still has it in its possession. So they haven't even been able to analyze that data to determine who was at fault and whether or not they should continue to halt the testing of their self-driving cars across the city. So it's difficult to say really whether or not, you know, the vehicle operator could have prevented this accident.
And what about other cities where Uber is testing self-driving vehicles? Are city officials likely to stop these tests altogether?
So we're not seeing a lot of city officials asking for or calling for the banning of testing in general. I mean, Uber has halted testing across the four cities that they're testing right now. And that's going to be sort of determined based on what the data brings back. But we are seeing a lot of calls for Congress to really take the time to, think about the bill that's currently in Congress that could regulate autonomous vehicles. Senator Blumenthal, who has has vocally opposed or at least asked the Congress to be more cautious about how they're regulating this new technology, again, reiterated those concerns yesterday. So we may see some more delays on the congressional bill.
Is it part of the problem here that these autonomous vehicles learn to drive better over time? So tests on real streets and in real situations are necessary, but obviously things can go wrong.
Definitely. So the way that autonomous technology learns is by experiencing new situations. And so in order to be able to ultimately operate on public roads everywhere, they have to be tested on public roads. And so in what's supposed to happen is in a situation where the autonomous system cannot navigate that situation, the vehicle operator is supposed to take over, log that, and then, you know, bring it back to HQ. They simulate that same situation, and then that autonomous technology across the board learns how to navigate that later on in public roads. The problem with that is we're depending, one, on a human to be alert and ready to take over as necessary, and two, on an imperfect system, where basically there is an inherent admission that that technology is not yet ready to be fully driverless. And so our question really, I mean, there is a pretty high likelihood that we're going to continue to see these incidents because, you know, the technology is not fully ready yet. So the question is, how much of a risk is the public, the regulators, and the industry willing to take on in pursuit of this ultimate goal of reducing or getting close to eliminating traffic-related accidents down the road?
What does this mean for Uber as a company? It's not like Facebook where we can watch their stock drop after what just happened in the last few days, but they're a private company, so we can't see that. But what does it mean for them?
Right. So Uber's self-driving arm is in the midst of, you know, attempting to strike commercial partnerships with automakers and other companies, and the company wants to go public in 2019. So self-driving development and research is incredibly expensive. They have to be able to nail down their commercial strategy now. And this, even if Uber's technology is not found to be at fault, the perception in and of itself could hurt their chances at striking these partnerships or the partnerships that they already have.
And people have pointed out that this was one fatality. There are more than 3,000 deaths every day due to road crashes.
Right. I mean, it's difficult to compare human driving to self-driving right now, just because, you know, there are, you know, each company only has about 100 or up right. to 1,000 cars on the road and are not driving nearly as many miles. But it is far more significant with human driving.
That's Johanna Bouya, senior editor at Recode. Johanna, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.